Those of you who were at the Unbound Book Fest this year may have set in on a panel discussion that was featuring my guest, who's also written a book that has been published by the University of Missouri Press. And it's a pleasure to be able to welcome him to talk about the book that is called The 1st Infantry Division and the U.S. Army Transformed, Road to Victory in Desert Storm. Greg Fontenot joins us now. Good to talk to you. How are you today, sir?
I'm well, sir. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about the book.
When did you start working on this book?
Well, I retired from civil service in 2013 in order to write. And that summer, the McCormick Foundation offered some money to do research and to write a book about the 1st Infantry Division. And the project appealed to me because I was a combat veteran of the division, so I took it on. Air Force started in the fall of 13.
I have a greater appreciation for the 1st Infantry Division, but again, as a person who has never served in the military, I don't understand some of all of the military, like even in the divisions and these kinds of things. Help me understand and help listeners who maybe don't know why. What is a 1st Infantry Division? How significant is that?
Well, this infantry division that we're talking about, the very 1st Infantry Division, is in fact 100 years old this month. And the notion of a division is an old term that you can find it in BC, prehistory, mm-hmm. pre-Christian history. And it literally meant a division of an army. You know, you divide your army into three or four parts, then three or four divisions. The organization that I fought with in 1991, of course, bore no similarity to, say, a division as it existed in 1862 at Gettysburg, or even today. These things are dynamic. They change based on the equipment and doctrine of the time. But the division of 1990-91 would have been about 18,000 people organized in three brigades, a smaller grouping, which brought together combined arms units of infantry battalions and armor battalions. In the 1st Infantry Division, it was a curious infantry division because it actually went to war with six armor battalions and three infantry battalions. Its regular organization was five infantry and four tank, but we took the 3rd Brigade of the 2nd AD instead of our own brigade, and we had to leave back our National Guard roundout battalion. Hmm. So a division in Desert Storm was 9 maneuver battalions, some combination of infantry and armor, and a cavalry squadron supported by an aviation brigade and an artillery brigade of about 18,000 people.
When I hear you give that answer, and when I was heading into reading as much of your book as I can, and I went through a good portion of your book, I was thinking, I oftentimes think of the military as something less than a human element to it. I don't know if I can explain this really well. It's almost like a machine. And I don't think of the human side of the decision making and what is playing out within that. It seems like once the leaders of a military unit or a branch of the service get to talking about it, it almost sounds machine-like rather than made up of human beings. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, of course I do. It's because every profession has its own lexicon, mm-hmm. and it's difficult for them not to get into that lexicon. You know, I just had orthopedic surgery. If you listen to my surgeon talk, you know, there are a lot of words he used that I didn't understand. I'd have to ask for clarification on.
Yeah.
But that's because that's the nature of professions and institutions. That what I try to do with this book, though, is open up the institution so that regular Americans could get a sense of what it's like, because my impression is Americans don't understand what their military does, how it does it, how it's organized to do it. And this book is an attempt. You know, after all, nobody even gets shot at in this book until chapter 6. Mm-hmm. It is a military history, but it's also the history of the institution and how the humans in the institution function.
Greg Fontenot is our guest. His book is The 1st Infantry Division and the U.S. Army Transformed, Road to Victory in Desert Storm, 1970 to 1991. Let's take up the word transformed, because this is what strikes me, especially throughout the real early portions of the book and deep into the book. And then I found references to it as you were explaining its impact. Something like the fact that we went from a a drafted force to volunteer forces. I thought you described and explained that well. I think we perhaps can intuit what we know from outside of what that might have been like. But from inside looking at that, some of the points of the impact of volunteer forces as opposed to people who had been drafted into the military.
That is a great thing to talk about, because fundamentally the transformation of the Army after the Vietnam War was a consequence of the Army's perception of its failure in the Vietnam War, as well as a notion that never again would we have that kind of failure where units didn't achieve what they might have. There was a clear sense that the United States Army needed to reform itself from within. Moreover, there was a sense, because of the political anxiety that the war caused, that we were eventually, it wasn't clear in 1969, as it became clear, but 1969, when General Westmoreland took over as Chief of Staff of the Army, it was by no means clear the draft was going to go away. Mm. The draft is institutionalized by President Wilson in April of 1917, had intended to have universal liability for service. That was the intention. It had been watered down and changed for all the reasons we all know about it, and it was clear it was going to end. Break. So what did that mean? Westmoreland came home in the summer of 69. He looked around, and it was clear to him that the Army would lose the draft. And then in the absence of a draft, it would be difficult to maintain the Army at the with the quality soldiers that it needed. You may remember the so-called McNamara 100,000, where soldiers that didn't meet recruits that didn't meet basic entry requirements were admitted to the Army in order to meet numbers. So Westmoreland immediately did two things that summer. First of all, he created an office called the Special Assistant for the Modern Volunteer Army, and he began to look at how to recruit more women, because he believed that recruiting women would enable women to take positions that men had previously held, and would allow the Army to maintain the quality of recruits it needed. He thought he could recruit more women that met the quality that he needed than he could if he just stayed with men. So with integration of women was a business decision and had nothing to do with the feminist movement, and it predated candidate Nixon's announcement of the volunteer Army. The second thing he did is prepare for that to happen, and again, predated candidate Nixon's announcement. So the Army understood it had a problem, had to get ahead of it. That's on the volunteer side. Do you want to add anything to that, or can I transition and talk doctrine?
Well, I didn't realize even some of the logistics of going to a volunteer force. You mentioned in the book how no longer was there going to be KP duty, or you would have maybe a 5-day work week, or maybe change on the hair. Those are kind of the little things that kind of can distract those of us who look at those minute things, although I think that they played a role bigger than what those things are when you add them up, and then all of a sudden you've got a larger picture of how you had to approach those who were going to be in the military that had volunteered to be there.
You make a great point, David, and I underplayed that because I lived through it.
Uh-huh.
Prior to the volunteer Army, everybody was liable to the draft, and you were therefore not accorded the privileges of a volunteer. If you're a conscripted soldier, we were going to have you live in the barracks. You were going to do kitchen police, that is, maintain the barracks yourself. You're going to cut the grass outside. You're going to do everything that had to be done. So in 1950, we had a 600,000-man army but couldn't man 10 divisions. It was because draftees did everything. There were no contractors doing anything on army posts. By 1973, when we go to the volunteer army, in order to make it work, in order to attract volunteers, you got to say, all right, what are those things that contribute nothing to soldierly skills? And one of the things that immediately comes to mind, what is the utility of kitchen police?
Mm-hmm.
What is the utility of mowing grass? I mean, none of that had much utility. The second thing is if you're going to let volunteers in, you can't restrict their rights the way you did conscripts. Conscripts weren't allowed to get married.
Mm-hmm.
They had to get permission to get married. Well, now, all of a sudden, you have people coming out of the Army married. And at the time, they weren't being paid in accordance with being a volunteer. When President Nixon had negotiated a pay raise, as I recall, in 72, among other things, we raised rations pay, a separate allowance for rations for the first time since 1947. So soldiers weren't well paid in 1972-73. And so the book reports, you know, guys working jobs at night, their families going without, soldiers and their families on WIC and food stamps and the like. And so pay had to change. Now, what's the outcome of that? Well, in the last 10 or 15 years, the cost of personnel in the military has averaged 8 or 9% per annum. So now you have the good news is you have all volunteers. The bad news is they're more expensive.
Yeah, and interesting. I'm glad you talked about those things because, indeed, that helped me understand then. If I'm an old military man, I'm thinking, doggone these soldiers. I liked it better when they were drafted because they just had to do what I told them to do, and I didn't have to soften things up. And I'm probably not using words that would be very appropriate for that. But you, again, understand what I mean. When you're looking at that change, then, again, that factors into strategies that you're going to make and what will happen later on when things like Desert Storm happen.
Sure it does. Though let me hasten to add, I worked with both drafted soldiers and with the volunteer army, and I had no difficulty with the drafted soldiers. The difference is drafted soldiers generally came into the military without the same skill sets that we're able to get when we took volunteers. And that is because despite Mr. Wilson's notion, and he's the one that used the word universal liability for service, the local draft boards didn't do that. So you've heard all the stories about, you know, George W. Bush flew in the National Guard, Mr. Clinton, President Clinton, you know, pulls out of the Air Force ROTC when it's clear he isn't going to have to serve. So what happened is draft boards didn't address universal liability as fairly as they might have. So you had the perception that only those who couldn't avoid the draft were serving.
Right.
Well, with the volunteer force, you don't have that. Volunteers, generally, my experience has been at the transition, were better educated, more willing, and were there for a reason. They wanted to soldier or they wanted to take advantage of the GI Bill. But either way, they were willing to soldier 3 or 4 years and do whatever was required of them. And so they make very good soldiers. The quality of the volunteer is very high, remains high to this very day, despite the long war. It's remarkable. The flip side is it's less representative of America than it might have been. Right after 9/11, you know, the so-called elite's children also joined the military forces. Now that we've been at it 14 or 15 years, that seems to me to be less so. I hasten to add, I don't have any polls to support that. That's anecdotal. But a volunteer force in the United States has tended to be less representative of population than a drafted force would have been, despite the fundamental flaws of the draft.
I like that conversation. We're going to have about 5 minutes left here, so I apologize that this is going to end way too soon. Let me give you a couple of things that stuck in my mind, and you can just comment on one or two of these. One of the things I learned was the importance of simulators and how you improved simulation so that people who were being prepared for battle would be able to better know what to expect through those simulations. I thought the training changes that you mentioned were attention-getting. I also wrote down mechanized versus modernized, and I don't know whether you want to comment on that or not, because I don't know if I fully understand that distinction, but I think the pace of mechanization and the pace of modernization didn't always follow the same speed.
No, they did not. In fact, you had in the army that went to war in Desert Storm, you had the curiosity of the comparatively ancient M113 improved, but still old technology, 50s technology, alongside the M1, which was late 70s, early 80s technology. So you have the force far more mechanized, that is, more vehicles, fewer people having to walk to work, and more modernized. But you can't modernize and mechanize at the same pace. I mean, mechanization is one thing. That's vehicles. Modernized vehicles, up-to-date vehicles, is a separate thing. You can't do that everywhere at once. So the Army is never going to have 100% readiness at the top level, most modern equipment. It's not possible. Or it is not possible, nor is it necessary or financially possible. With simulations, with training equipment, you can prepare folks and then modernize on the fly if the equipment's available, which is what we did in the 1st Infantry Division, because the 1st Infantry Division was not fully modernized. And in the 3 weeks between the time we got alerted and we loaded ships, we modernized. We got all kinds of new equipment. The United States can move at lightning speed when it needs to, and that's one of the things that Desert Storm, in fact, illustrated.
I'll have to let you go in just a moment, and we might have to talk again, because I think this is just I like learning about these things that I did not have a chance to learn of when I was younger. I was one of those who was happy that the draft ended, because I was just graduating high school in 1973 when that ended. Right after I graduated, I got my number, lottery number, but then I didn't have to worry about being called with a middle of the list number. My final question for you, the changes that you write about and concentrate on in your book from 1970 to 1991 covered about 21 years. Now, 1991 is 26 years ago, roughly. Have we seen a change comparable since 1991 as you write about between 70 and 91?
The answer to that is yes, but.
Okay.
And so the yes, but is, and I'll make it very quick. First of all, I hope some of your listeners will buy this book and read it, because it's about your Army. It's not my Army. It's about the United States Army, our Army. The yes, but is, at the end of the end of Desert Storm, it was also the end of the Cold War, it was clear the United States was going to take a peace dividend of one kind or another. The leadership of the Army, General Fred Franks, General Gordon Sullivan, and the Vice Chief of Staff of the Army, General Benny P., understood collectively that they weren't going to recapitalize the force. They weren't going to build new gear. So they did the next best thing. They digitally connected the force in a project called Force 21. That's the Army that fought in the opening stages of Iraqi freedom, and it was an Army in which they were all digitally connected. You could see friendly forces on a screen inside the tank turret, and you could communicate using digits. They have not recapitalized the force, and probably will not over the short haul because of the cost of doing so.
Well, we have just barely moved a pebble of sand in this story, and I'm thinking of the picture on the front cover of this book with the tanks going across the desert sand. And so people will be interested in this, especially those who want to know more about the 1st Infantry Division, or have connections with that, or maybe fought in Desert Storm, or, again, want to know about the Army and an interesting history of the Army over the last less than half century. Greg Fontenot, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. And I'm going to tell people how they can get this book, okay?
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. It's the 1st Infantry Division and the U.S. Army Transformed, Road to Victory in Desert Storm, 1970 to 1991. You can order the book through the University of Missouri Press, which is online at upress.missouri.edu. I'm also told that copies are available at the Boone County Historical Society Museum store for purchase there. This is News Talk 1400 KFRU.